Exactly backwards. And so if you, when you think concerning the past, when you think that direction, if you think down, primitive, more primitive, you've got evolution stuck in your head. Because the Bible says it's up. Okay? Job says the ancients knew more than we know. And there are all kinds of things in the earth that we cannot explain on the basis of our technology today. We cannot explain on the basis of our knowledge today. Okay? All kinds of things. But if you take the Bible for what it says, there is an explanation for them. And that is, people knew more than we do now. People were more technologically advanced before. Okay? So if you see Noah making the ark with a stone hatchet attached to a piece of wood, you have evolution stuck in your head. Because there was a man living at the time of Noah's life that could make anything out of metal. Anything. You know, like that. Read the book of Genesis very carefully. It makes anything out of metal. Now, I don't exactly see Noah working with a Black & Decker power saw, but that there may have been electricity at that time, I'm not exactly sure. How about that? See, we think electricity is a modern invention. There's a battery in the Baghdad Museum. Puts out 1.5 volts of electricity, still puts it out, and it's 4,000 years old, from 1000 BC. Now, why don't our battery companies today put out things like that? Because they want to make money. You see? Now, these people knew how to make batteries. Now, let me ask you a question. Why do you make a battery? To run something that runs on electricity. You don't just make batteries for the fun of it, do you? Make batteries to run things that run electricity. Okay? 1000 BC? Well, we'll get to some of those other interesting little tidbits like that later. Okay? These are the kind of things the evolutionists never mention in their book. They never mention things like that. They even try to hide things like that because they can't handle them. So what do you think when you think about the past? Do you think up or do you think down? There are lots of structures on the earth that cannot be explained by uniformitarian principles. Such as the large overthrust that there are in the earth. An overthrust is like this. You have the strata of the earth, and then because of some kind of force or whatever, you'll have a break, and then one piece of the land will be moving this direction, and the other one either stays still or it's moving the other direction, and then you get a situation like this. Okay? And you get what's called an overthrust, where this actually is on top of that one. The problem with that is that will not explain the uniformitarian principle, such as, you know, water being moved gradually through rivers or whatever, or even plate movement on the earth will not explain some of the overthrusts that people say are overthrusts in the earth. There is one called the Lewis overthrust that in the United States that covers thousands of square miles. And yet there are places where the one, they can tell that this has been inverted, right? They can tell that that is on top of that and it really should be straight off from it. You got the idea? They can tell it's a duplication of the same strata, in other words. They can tell that that's on top of that and there is no evidence at this line that there was any movement. See, but they call that an overthrust. Now, if that were an overthrust, and one thing went over the top of the other, and grated along there due to gravity, one of those uniformitarian principles, you see, due to gravity, wouldn't that have left some kind of indication that that great movement had taken place? And yet there is no indication in certain places that there was any movement at all that had taken place. Got that? Uniformitarian principles will not explain that. The flood will. The flood will explain that. If those were two very soft layers of silt that had been laid down after a catastrophe like the flood, and then great movements in the earth took place, you can have clay slide across the top of clay or silt across whatever, and not leave any evidence later after it hardens. The problem is we've got it stuck in our heads that all of these layers are so old, you see, and that's because evolution stuck in our heads. But aren't those layers really old? Are they? I'm going to check that one out again. Okay, no more than about 6,000 years. Okay, and so what about mountains that are upside down? How do you explain that on the basis of uniformitarian principles? Or how about fossils? Ever thought of that? What about fossils? How do you explain fossils on the basis of uniformitarian principles? You realize that the soft parts of a clam have been found? How do you have the soft parts of a clam fossilized down to the cellular level when a clam sitting around is going to decay within a period of a few hours? And yet they found that kind of evidence in the earth. Oh, it's interesting, the fossil evidence that they found for before the flood. As far as I'm concerned, it's before the flood. They think it's billions of years ago. But you realize there were cockroaches before the flood that were 1 foot long? Awful, isn't it? I mean, you could put them on your feet and ride around. One on each foot, see? Well, wouldn't this be cute? Don't you think it'd be cute? 6 foot penguins? Can you imagine a penguin as big as a man? A guy leading around a penguin with a rope, you know? Come on. It's a penguin, 6 feet tall. Or how'd you like to be riding a motorcycle and get hit by a dragonfly that has a 6 foot wingspan? Yes, dragonflies with a 6 foot wingspan. Everything was bigger and better, at least as complex, before the flood. And yet they tell us, well, we can see in the fossil record that everything is developing. Developing? May I ask how development from 1 foot to however long cockroaches get is a development? Or from 6 feet down to this tall, or, you know, your biggest penguin, is a development? May I ask exactly why that's a development? Okay. What constitutes shrinkage in size being a development? You could question their thinking, much less their value system. Okay, we'll get into some other things like that. Interesting things happened before the flood. People were bigger then, too, lived longer. Right? So, third thing, are we really only on the third thing? Out of 11? What about cause and effect? Cause and effect. What do we observe all the time as human beings and never observe anything different than that? Is that the cause is always greater than the effect. And what does evolution say? The cause is less than the effect. The effect is greater than the cause. And it says that not only physically that life came from something that was non-life. Of course, they would say, they could ask the same question, in what sense is life greater than non-life? And I'd say, that's a problem you have in your presupposition, not mine. You see the point? Tired, huh? See the point? That's a problem in their presupposition. They say, they may say, well, in what sense are you saying that life is better than non-life? And I would say, that's just the way that we live, folks. That's the way we intuit it. It's the way that we understand it. You will conclude, evolutionist or not, that your baby is more important than the rock on the floor. You will live that way whether you try to say that you're an evolutionist or not. And so that's a problem in your presupposition, but not in mine. You see, he will have trouble living that out if he says that life is not as important, is not any more important than non-life. Got the idea? A girl told me one time that a person was no more important than a snail because the electrochemical reactions in the person's nervous system were not any more significant than those in the nervous system of a snail. And I said, does that mean that if I step on the snail or if I shoot you, that there's no difference? And she said, that's right. And I said, did you protest the war in Vietnam? She was very, very quiet. She didn't answer that because she was a hypocrite. She said that people were no more important than snails, but that she didn't act like that when she protested the war in Vietnam. She said it was a significant thing that was happening by protesting the war. So she didn't have anything she could say. She was a hypocrite. Okay? We can be hypocrites. We can choose to live contrary to our presupposition. We can be hypocrites.
Everyone with a false philosophy, that is everybody that's other than a Christian, must be hypocrites. Because they must live the way God has created them to live, which means their living will be one way and their philosophy will be another. So they will say one thing and do another. And so we can be hypocrites. They must be hypocrites in some fashion. Okay, so what does evolution say? It says a whole lot of time, plus a whole lot of matter, energy, and motion, if you want to make a really fancy statement of it, plus a whole lot of chance equals a human being. Okay? Now, is time personal or impersonal? Impersonal. Matter and energy? Impersonal. Chance? Impersonal equals it. Okay? So what they are saying is the impersonal plus the impersonal plus the impersonal equals the personal, which means that the cause is less than the effect. That is a problem in personality. It's also a problem scientifically with the laws of physics. So then, the ultimate cause of life is the impersonal in evolution. The ultimate cause of life is the impersonal in evolution. And you have all the philosophical problems that come from saying that man is not a person. You can work that out on your own time. You can work that out on your own time. Okay, number four, I must go on. And I'm sorry, I haven't given you a break. We're just going to plunge on. Otherwise, you're going to be up all night. This is all for Tom's sake. Don't you love Tom? You'll do it for Tom, won't you? That didn't sound very convinced. You'll do it for Tom, won't you? Yeah, okay. We're all loyal to Tom. We want him to get some sleep sometime tonight. Okay. Design. Number four is the idea of design. You have the problem of complexity and design in the universe. The problem is not that we can't find design in the midst of all the chaos. The problem is that it's very difficult finding any chaos in the midst of all the design. C.S. Lewis put it this way. Man looks at the universe and he is so overwhelmed by all of the design because everything is designed. He's so overwhelmed by all of the design that he can't handle it with his mind because he's finite. The Bible says through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God. We can't handle it with our little brains. We have to choose to trust that the revelation that God has given, that this is the way it's happened. God spoke it and it came to be. And so the man's mind so boggles at the magnitude of the complexity that's in the universe that he has to try to conclude that that is all chaotic and then try to find some kind of order that he can handle with his own finite mind. Got the whole thing turned around. But let's consider the idea of complexity. For the first amino acids to be built, you had to have some amazing coincidences take place for the very first amino acids to be produced. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. But for those first amino acids to come together, you had to have some amazing coincidences of macromolecules coming together at the same time, in the same place. We'll get on to a little bit how amazing that is in a minute. For the first protein to develop, you had to have certain amino acids come together in a particular order, which was an amazing thing. And that is still a very, very far cry from those proteins being built together into a cell. And there the jump is so big that it boggles the mind mathematically for all the amino acids, or the proteins, to come together in just the right way for a cell to develop. Statistically, it works out like this. In order for the first cell to have developed by chance, you could have one chance happening that was positive happen every second through the history of the universe, which we will graciously say is 10 billion years old. They started out, you see, a lot less, and they kept increasing the time and increasing the time and increasing the time, not realizing they're hanging themselves with their own noose.
Okay? 10 billion years, every second, a positive chance occurrence takes place. Every second. Statistically speaking, there would not be enough seconds in the history of the universe for the first cell to happen by chance. Not enough seconds in the history of the universe in 10 billion years for the first cell to take place. And I mean, it's a phenomenal amount of time that you need, because it's something like 4 to 5 times that amount. You would need some 40 billion, 50 billion, maybe more, 100 billion years for the first cell to come about by chance, with one chance occurrence happening every second of those 50 billion years. A positive chance occurrence. Now that's being awfully gracious, don't you think? To say that a positive one would happen every second? Okay? That is, even statistically speaking, physically speaking, that's just not possible. And yet, even if you gave them that much time, it still could not have taken place. More time for the evolutionist, he thinks, is a help, but it really is a problem. Because the more time you give for instance, a chemical solution, such as on the primordial earth, the more time you give a solution to sit, the greater the equilibrium is in the solution. The less possibility that there will be a chemical reaction or anything will happen chemically in the solution. So the more time you give yourself, the less opportunity there is for anything to happen by chance. You got the idea? The chemical law that the longer a solution sits undisturbed, the greater the equilibrium will be in the solution, the less possibility there is for any kind of an occurrence or chemical reaction to take place in the solution. And so the more time they give themselves, the less opportunity there is. And another question that we would have, great question that we have, is what about right-handed and left-handed molecules? Now, when you have a molecule that's composed of atoms, if we can use the Newtonian idea, you have a molecule that's composed of atoms, and it goes like this. You can have the 5 atoms of a molecule, whatever they happen to be, carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, whatever. You know, I don't know if you find those two together, but if you've got all these two together like that, and then you can have them, you can have all 5 atoms, and you can put them together this way, or you can put them together this way. And are those two the same? No. They're not the same. Got that? They're not the same. Even though the same atoms are involved in the molecule, one is right-handed, the other one is left-handed. And scientists refer to right-handed and left-handed molecules. See? When you have a chemical reaction, I'm not positive this happens with every chemical reaction. Somebody that's a chemist here can tell me. But I'm pretty sure that with most chemical reactions, you will have, in a chemical reaction, right-handed and left-handed molecules that are arranged. Because they can arrange themselves both directions, given the particular valences of the atom. Okay, electric valences. We're not getting into that. But you have right-handed and left-handed molecules. Now, question. Since right-handed and left-handed molecules happen in chemical reactions, why is it that all of the life on the earth is right-handed? Why don't we have one system of life on the earth that's right-handed and the other one that's left-handed? With all these wonderful chance occurrences taking place, why didn't we have chance occurrences that happened left-handed as well as right-handed? I don't think there's an answer to that. Okay. If the possibility was as great for the left-handed as it was for the right, which is in any solution, it would be that way. Let me tell you some interesting things about left-handed, right-handed molecules. These are really interesting. And life. They have developed, a man has developed left-handed sugar. And anything that is left-handed, because life is determinedly right-handed, anything that is left-handed is either totally useless to the right-handed organism, or it is poisonous. This guy has developed left-handed sugar, and it is totally useless to the right-handed organisms that ingest it. The only difference is that it looks exactly like sugar, tastes exactly like sugar, responds in cooking
exactly like sugar, but does not react in your body as a carbohydrate. How about that? And so in other words, when you use left-handed sugar in your baking, all of the sugar that you put in does not affect you in any way as a carbohydrate in your body. See? So a diabetic could eat a spoonful of left-handed sugar, would not affect them in any way, because it doesn't respond as a carbohydrate in your system. Right? The only problem with that is, of course, as far as diets is concerned, that'd be wonderful. You get all the sugar you want, it wouldn't bother you. But the problem with it is that they cannot mass produce it just yet because it's so complicated to produce it. And so I bet the guy is trying to figure out how to mass produce it so that he can make left-handed sugar. Wouldn't that be quite a boon? Okay? Now, have you ever thought about why worms such as tapeworms and other kinds of worms that live in your intestinal system are not digested? Never asked that question, huh? Why doesn't my stomach digest a tapeworm? That is because the worm produces, on its outside surface, produces a ring of molecules that are left-handed all the way around its surface. Okay. Hang on there. It produces a ring of molecules all the way around its surface, and your body can only digest something that is right-handed. So as far as your body is concerned, the worm is saying to it, I am not digestible. Because your enzymes don't work on left-handed molecules. Isn't that interesting? So what you have to do is knock the crazy worm for a loop with some kind of a chemical. Okay? And then when it's knocked for a loop, one part of it will start to break down. And then the enzymes can work on that. Usually what you do is you pass them before they're digested anyway. Okay? Not get into that particular thing. But under an electron microscope one time, these scientists were watching. You can't watch anything for very long under an electron microscope because it kills anything that's under it. But these scientists, except for spiders it seems, they last for like 20 minutes or a half an hour under an electron microscope. Isn't that interesting? If we had a nuclear war, the spiders would be left. Something at least would probably survive. They would last. So under electron microscope one time, the scientists thought that they'd do a crazy thing, and they stripped the bacteria of a part of its cell wall, or exactly what it was, a bacterium, excuse me. And they stripped it of part of its wall, I think with acid of some sort, and damaged the bacterium. And they're watching this large bacterium, and they've got these macromolecules. I would have loved to see this. Would have been really interesting. I probably would have been just as shocked as they were at what happened. But what they did was introduce macromolecules to the bacterium that the bacterium could use to repair itself if it could use them, but the problem was that they were left-handed, the macromolecules. And so this bacterium has these left-handed molecules around it, and so what does the bacterium do? Does it shun the molecule? Does it die because it's in contact with the molecules? No. It does something that's totally physically impossible as far as the scientists are concerned. It tears the left-handed molecule apart, puts it back together as a right-handed molecule, and adopts it to itself. And these scientists go, you what? You did what? No, they couldn't believe their little eyes. Life is so determined to be right-handed that it would even take the left-handed molecule, put it back together. Okay, right-handed molecule, I'll take that. I would have loved to have seen the look on their faces. They were quite shocked. I mean, what do you do with something like that? And I was so glad they found out that there were things in space that they couldn't figure out at all when they sent out the probe into space from America. And they found out that they found that, first of all, that Jupiter has rings as well as Saturn. And then they found out that the rings on Saturn do all kinds of crazy physical things they're not supposed to be doing, like doing figure eights and stuff like that. They're just not supposed to do that physically, but they're doing it. Mm-hmm. So now what are the scientists going to do? They're just going to have to change a few of their theories, aren't they? That's all they can do. And I think that God made the duck-billed platypus just for the evolutionists. Okay? I think he had that in mind. If man ever rebels against me, he's going to come up with some crazy concoction someday, thinking that everything's happened by chance. I'll fix this one. I'll build it right into the creation. Okay? We won't go into that anymore. Okay, we've already talked about the second law of thermodynamics. I won't have to talk about that anymore. It's one of the most well-attested of physical laws. Whatever evolution says, however, is contrary to the second law of thermodynamics. Because entropy says everything is running downhill. Evolution says everything is running uphill. Okay? So it is contrary to what we observe happening in the creation. Okay, now, number six. Number five was thermodynamics. Number six, is the Earth old or is it young? How old is the Earth? Another section you need to study. Concerning radiometric dating, which I'm not going to talk very extensively on this, but concerning radiometric dating, you know what that is? They talk about carbon dating, potassium-argon dating, strontium-rubidium dating, all these different forms of radiometric dating. And the problem, I'll explain, do you know basically what that is, radiometric dating? It has to do with the idea that one material that is unstable in its molecular structure and its atomic structure can change to be another material by giving off part of its nucleus. Got the idea? The atom gives off part of its nucleus, okay? And then by doing that becomes another material. Okay? Strontium becomes rubidium, potassium becomes argon. Okay? These kinds of things change because you have to have a radioactive isotope of the particular kind of material, but those exist in creation. Okay, so here we've got this unstable element, and by giving off a particular part of its atomic structure, it becomes another element. The time that it takes for the material to do that is a particular time that you can measure. How long that takes right now. We cannot guarantee, however, that it has always been happening that quickly, and scientists will admit that heat and water, it's very amazing, heat and water, and you know what I bet? I bet they'll find out that pressure does the same thing. Heat and water will change the speed at which that process takes place. But because living things commonly contain these elements that are unstable, by testing the amount of particular elements in the fossil or whatever it is that they happen to have there that they're testing, by testing that and finding out how much of the stable element is there, they can try to figure out exactly how long ago the thing existed. Okay? Now the problem with that, of course, is that that changes with water and heat. Those are two things they know change the rate. They don't commonly talk about that, though. But let's look at some other problems with this. You have to assume certain things to be true if you're going to do radiometric dating. First of all, you have to assume that the rate of decay is constant. The rate of change from one element to another is constant. You also have to assume that at the beginning of the whole schmear of creation, at the beginning, everything was purely radioactive, and there were no sister elements. There were none of the stable elements at all. Because if it was mixed at the beginning, you wouldn't be able to tell now what of it had come from decay and what of it had come from just being that way in the beginning, could you? See? Because you would look at it and you'd go, it's got this much of the sister element, but we don't know how much of it was originally there and how much of it came from decay, radioactive decay. And so it assumes that there was no mixture at the beginning, but it was pure, which cannot be assumed by a scientist. He doesn't know what it was like at the beginning. That can't be assumed. You also cannot assume that the rate of decay was consistent. Let me give you an illustration. You walk into an old house, an old rundown house. You walk in there and you find a table, and on the table there is a candle. And the candle is burning. And you go, oh, isn't this interesting, a candle burning. Somebody must have lit this candle in here. Okay? Now, the candle is now burning, it is presently burning, at a rate of 1 inch per hour. You measure that as it is burning for 3 or 4 hours, and you see that it is burning at 1 inch per hour. Now, I would like to ask you some questions about it. How long was it burning? That's the basic question about radiometric dating. How long was the candle burning? That's the problem. Depends on how long the candle was, how tall the candle was, and also depends on what?
whether it was continually burning at that rate. Who knows that maybe there was a draft through the house at one time and it burned at a faster rate when the wind was blowing through the house. You see? There could have been other elements that caused the candle to burn at a faster rate at some time, and so you cannot tell how long the candle has been burning. You can't tell that because there are things that you do not know. And it's exactly the same with radiometric dating. They cannot tell by what kind of element is there now how long ago it started decaying. They can't tell that because they need to know whether or not the rate of decay was constant and whether or not how much of the original radioactive element was there. And they can't tell that. Okay? So then what happens is, people think that the geologic column, they think that the geologic column was arranged because of radiometric dating. But the geologic column existed long before radiometric dating ever came along. The evolutionists had worked out the geologic column, which, by the way, appears nowhere in the Earth as evolutionists picture it in their books. Nowhere. It is strictly the structure of their imagination. And what is it based on? The theory of evolution. You see? Nowhere will you find the order all the way through that they say exists on the Earth. Right? And you know, sometimes you will find that the order is completely reversed. You'll find older layers, quote, older layers, on top of younger layers. Okay? You'll find them mixed up, young, old. You'll find two layers mixed together so that the fossil from making one layer, the fossils from two layers will be in one layer sometimes. How about that? You see? Now, the processes of uniformitarianism do not explain that, but the flood does. If all these things were in suspension, in silt, because of a flood at some time, then it does explain why certain things would be in certain layers, other things would be in other layers, but at the same time, some layers would be on top of others, others would be mixed. Okay? The flood will explain that. We'll get to that in just a minute. Hang on. The geologic column, the ages of the world that scientists say are there were worked out long before radiometric dating ever came along. And when a date from radiometric dating is in contradiction to the theory of evolution, they always say we must have done our dating incorrectly or something is wrong with this. Maybe it isn't really from that particular era. Something. They'll assume that something is wrong with the dating because evolution couldn't possibly be wrong. And yet at the same time, they find all kinds of things that are way out of their system and they ignore them. Leakey, one of the foremost evolutionists of our time, held up a skull, a human skull, and he said this was found in Precambrian rock. He said, if this is true, that this was found in Precambrian rock, we may as well all go out and become truck drivers because the theory of evolution is completely shot full of holes. Was it found in Precambrian rock? Yes, it was found in Precambrian rock. Have you ever heard anything about that in any of your science books? Have you ever heard anything about it recently on the radio, television? How many evolutionists bring up that bit of evidence? Have you ever seen it? You know what they did with that? They buried it. It is a loss somewhere. And will evolutionists bring it up? No. They're not going to do that. Why? Because they're prejudiced. They don't want evolution to be shown to be untrue. And so they bury any contrary evidence. In Texas, near the Rose River, there are, near the Paluxy River, there are dinosaur footprints that have been fossilized. And you know what are going in between the dinosaur footprints? Human footprints. You know what that means? Humans and dinosaurs were alive at the same time. Now, I've always puzzled over, I wonder if the man was chasing the dinosaur, if the dinosaur was chasing the man. But you can't tell from the footprint, you know? I just hope the guy wasn't being chased by a dinosaur. Poor guy. Okay, so the human footprints are in there. And so what did the evolutionary scientists do? They came, took the piece of rock, chiseled out the piece of rock that had the dinosaur footprint in it, left the human footprint right next to it. And when asked, why they weren't taking that one, they said, those cannot be real because men did not live when dinosaurs did. That's called blindness. Okay? Now, there are a lot of processes that favor a young Earth. They favor a young Earth. Things like the gravitational decrease on the Earth. The gravitational pull of the Earth is decreasing exponentially. It's not a simple addition. It's exponentially decreasing. You know what that means? Exponentially? Okay. It's like if it decreases by a factor of 2 this 100 years, it'll decrease by a factor of 4 the next 100 years, by a factor of 16 the next 100 years. See, it squares every time. Okay? And so it's decreasing exponentially. And if you work it backwards, if you work it backwards to about 6,000-7,000 years ago, at the most 10,000 years, the gravitational field of the Earth would have been so strong, man couldn't have lived on it, nothing could have lived on it. Actually, the Earth would have collapsed on itself if you work it back any farther than about 10,000 years. Because it is decreasing very rapidly. Now, it's decreasing rapidly compared to, you know, the time of the existence of the Earth, maybe, in thousands of years. You could say it's decreasing rapidly if you're gauging it over hundreds of years. Okay? It's not decreasing so rapidly we have to worry about flying off the Earth tomorrow or anything like that. So tomorrow the gravity will be a little bit less than it was today, and so you'll feel a little bit lighter. Okay? But it will be so small that you probably won't notice it. Okay, that's one thing. Where am I? Gravitational decrease. The sediment on the ocean floors is not nearly as thick as it should be for having been put there for thousands of years. Excuse me, billions of years. It fits with thousands of years. It does not fit with billions of years. The minerals, concentration of minerals in ocean water is not nearly as strong as it should be for having had minerals flow into it for billions of years. And the population increase on the Earth isn't nearly as great as it should be for billions of years. Or do they say it's only in the last, 1.5 million years or something that man has been on the Earth? It depends on the evolutionist that you're reading. Some of them say 3/4, some of them say 1.5 million or something like that. But anyway, given that long, we should not have as few people as we do have on the Earth today. Okay? And then another problem with us as creationists is the appearance of age that is in the Earth. The Earth appears to be very, very old. Now, why is that, that the Earth appears to be old? Because natural processes must be created in the midst of the process. You can't create a natural process at the beginning of the process. You have to create a natural process in the middle of the process. Okay? So when Adam was made, he couldn't be made as a baby, could he? He couldn't take care of himself. He had to be made as a man. And so the natural process of reproduction and so forth had to be broken into right in the middle with an adult human being. Bam! Adult. Okay? Because you couldn't start with a baby and expect it to get along by itself. Couldn't do that. Couldn't start at the beginning of the process. I mean, what if God had started with a sperm and an egg and just left it there? Sitting on the ground. Without some intervention from God, it wasn't going to go very far. Okay? So Adam had to be created right then. So if a scientist had walked up to Adam, say, hypothetically speaking, this guy walks up to Adam and he looks at Adam's body and he goes, "Well, it looks like you're maybe 35, 40 years old," and Adam says, "Well, according to my cosmic clock, it's about 30 seconds ago that I was made." 30 seconds, huh? He says, "Yeah, 35 seconds now." He says, "Well, no, you can't be." Well, of course he's going to look old, because God can't make a process starting at the beginning, because it won't continue. Okay? The process would stop there. And so he has to make it in the middle. Or what about the stars? A lot of people use the idea that the stars, the light coming from the stars, has to have been coming for so many millions of years because they're so far away, a lot of which is assumption. But we'll just let them have that. We'll concede that point. Let's say they are millions of light years away. Is it necessary that the light has been coming for millions of years?
No.
Because God since he made the light for lights upon the stars, for lights upon the earth, could have made the star all of the lights in between and the earth too. Okay? He would have to make a natural process in the midst of the natural process. If he had made the stars at the beginning of the creation 10,000 years ago, and some of them are millions of light years away, we wouldn't have had the light from them yet. We would still not know that they even existed. Okay, that's another thing. And what about eggs? God had to make chickens rather than eggs because the eggs wouldn't hatch. Didn't he? Okay, yes, that's the answer to the which came first, the chicken or the egg. The chicken came first, and we know that by revelation. Okay. Okay. Was God involved in deception then? No, he wasn't involved in deception. There really wasn't any other way he could have made it. A lot of people think God was involved in deception because the earth somehow looks old. Well, no, but God could not make anything except in the midst of the process, and so he had to make it with an appearance of age. A chicken looks like it came from an egg. But when God first said, let there be fowl to fly in the midst of the heavens, there were fowl, not eggs. Isn't that wonderful? There wasn't eggs flying in the midst of the heavens. They wouldn't last very long, would they? Okay, well, what about the fossils and the strata? What about the fossils and the strata? How were fossils formed? Boy, going on a long time in evolution, you must need this. How are the fossils formed? Can they be explained on the basis of uniformitarian principles? No, they can't. How do you have things sitting around long enough to be able to fossilize without some kind of a catastrophe? Any kind of fossil assumes some kind of catastrophe, whether the evolutionist likes it or not. If something were to be buried, why should we find, through a slow process of sedimentation, why should we find something that is completely fossilized? Why wouldn't part of it be fossilized because it got buried quickly enough, and the other part of it be rotten, so we wouldn't find it at all? Okay? What about trees that extend through whole, petrified trees that extend through whole series, hundreds of feet of strata, vertically? What do you do with those? You've got a strata like this, and you've got this tree, it's like this, petrified. What about that? How does that happen in a uniformitarian principle? While this strata right here, stratum, is being laid down, which may take how many hundreds of years for that to be laid down, what is happening with the rest of the tree during that time that is sticking out of the ground or whatever, in the water, may we ask? What is happening with the rest of it? Why isn't it decaying? Why did this tree go through these millions of years of strata, part of it sticking out of the ground? Why didn't it decay? What would you expect to find in the fossil if evolution were true? You would expect to find thousands, if not millions, of intermediate forms from one animal to another within the species. Actually, across species is our problem. I don't have any problem within the species. But you would expect to find millions of forms, slightly different from the other. You'd at least expect to find a few forms, wouldn't you? I mean, if there were all these millions of creatures taking a very slow process of change from one thing to another, you would expect to find some kind of evidence of that in the layers of the earth. The problem is that that's not what we find. Another problem is we find inverted strata. We find mixed strata. The geologic column isn't found anywhere on the earth in its entirety, as the evolutionists say. So what happens is, give you an example of what happens. I was talking to a guy on the Dam Square in Amsterdam, and a brilliant guy, Dutch guy, spoke about 7 languages fluently. Disgusting. I think it's wonderful that he can speak it, but it's just disgusting that we're so deficient in languages, those of us from the United States. I think maybe 2 from Australia. You don't get the opportunity to speak a lot of other languages, so you don't learn them. But we don't learn them. Brother Andrew said that the language in heaven, what the language in heaven is going to be? Now, he's Dutch, right? The language in heaven, everybody's expecting him to say Dutch. See? The language in heaven is going to be English. Everybody went, English? And he said, yeah. I said, the Americans have never learned anything else, so we got to speak English.
Anyway, so he has an interesting sense of humor, Brother Anders. Where were we? The Dom Square in Amsterdam. I was talking with this young fellow who is quite brilliant, and we talked about what you would expect to find in the earth if evolution were true. And I said, what would you expect to find if evolution were true? And he said, multitudes of intermediate forms, one slightly different from the other, all kinds of antecedents to the forms that are found in one particular layer would be found in another. And I said, oh, interesting. So what would you expect to find if creation were true? And he said, highly complex forms arising suddenly with no antecedents. And I said, what do you find in the strata of the earth? And he said, highly complex forms arising suddenly with no antecedents. And I said, so what does that indicate? And he said, well, it indicates creation. And I said, well, have you made a decision on this? And he said, no, I'm not quite, I haven't made my decision on this yet. He said, but that's what it indicates to me so far. Okay. So here he was thinking about it. He was honest at that point. And I said, now, exactly why is it that scientists then are saying that evolution has taken place? And he says, oh, he says, what they say is that somehow in, there are gaps in the evolutionary record because in between the strata, there are all kinds of periods of time that are lost in there. And a lot of those intermediate forms, namely all of them, because they don't have any intermediate forms, a lot of those intermediate forms, or basically all of them, happened at times when the strata were not being laid down, because there are times when strata are laid down and times when strata are not. I went, oh, how interesting. And I said, and exactly what may I say, what is scientific, is science based on? And he said, observation. Right? And I said, so on what are they basing their idea of evolution? And he said, non-existent evidence. They're basing it on what? Nothing. And I said, then may I ask what you call these men? Do you call them scientists? And he said, no, I would call them philosophers. Quite the guy. He understood what he was getting very close to getting saved, too. Running the risk. Okay, what about dinosaurs? When did dinosaurs live? They lived before the flood. Dinosaurs lived before the flood, and they lived with men. Isn't that interesting? You have your own little pet dinosaur, as long as it was little. Imagine trying to have a big pet dinosaur. Woo! Some of them were huge. See? Right? You know why there could be reptilian bodies that large? Because they are cold blood. They were cold-blooded, see? You know why there could be reptilian bodies that were that large at that time? Because of the atmosphere on the earth. It was quite different then. The Bible says in Genesis 1 that God divided the waters which were above the firmament, the expanse in which the birds fly. Okay? He divided the waters which were above the firmament from the waters which were below the firmament and called the ones below the firmament seas. Okay, that means that there was a water layer in the atmosphere. It was either in vapor form or it could have actually been in water form in the atmosphere, which would have done what? It would have made the earth like a big terrarium. Okay? Would have made the earth like a big terrarium. And the description that is given of the earth at that time is like a terrarium, that during the evening a mist would go up from the surface of the ground and watered the ground. And if you've ever had a terrarium, you know that that's what happens in a terrarium in the evening. You'll have mist on the terrarium during the evening. Can't take questions, if that's a question. No, wouldn't pick you up. Wouldn't pick you up. Okay? You can ask me later if you want. A terrarium produces a mist during the evening when it starts to become a little cooler, right? And so a mist went up, and it says that there was no rain. No rain fell on the earth. That's why Noah was was so strange, because God said, rain's going to come, Noah. And he went, what's that? What is rain? Define rain, God. He doesn't know what this idea is, water falling from the sky. He's used to a mist going up from the surface of the ground, watering the ground. And so when there was this water layer, then it made the earth like a big terrarium. The climate was very likely warm and uniformly warm all over the entire earth. And that, by the way, is the way scientists think that the earth was before, because of the kind of vegetation that they find in the fossils. They say the earth must have been a warmer climate then. And it would have supported the reptilian bodies of dinosaurs at that time. And the lush vegetation that resulted because of the tropical climate and moist climate all around the world would have given them what they needed to eat. Okay? Because originally they were not carnivorous. Some of them probably became carnivorous, but originally they were not, because God said he gave the animals the plants to eat, just as he gave man the plants to eat. So man was supposed to be vegetarian originally. Okay? Now, when it came time for the flood, because of the wickedness of man, then God could very easily perform the flood. You say, where did all this water come from? A lot of it was from juvenile water, which came out of volcanic eruptions because the fountains of the deep were broken up, and water comes up in volcanic eruptions. But most of it probably came from the sky. And the Bible says that God opened up the windows of heaven and poured down water on the earth, as well as raining. It rained and God poured down water on the earth, which means something else happened besides raining. See? It very likely took the water layer, which was in the atmosphere, it's not there anymore. He took that, brought it down on the earth to create the flood. Okay? And then you'd say, but where did all the water go later, you see? Because evidently the oceans were a lot shallower than they are now. A lot shallower then than they are now. And in Psalm 104, it talks about God. God sat as king at the time of the flood. He ruled as the king at the time of the flood. And it says, during that time, the mountains rose up, and the valleys sank down, that the water might go to the place that he had appointed for it. Right? And the evolutionists still don't have any explanation for mountain building. There is no uniformitarian principle that can explain mountain building. Ask a geologist sometime. How would you say mountains are built? And is this an absolute principle or is this only a theory? And you will find that all there are right now are theories. The mountains rose up, the valleys sank down so that the water could go to the place that was appointed for it. That was in Psalm 104. Okay, so that's where the water went. Now, another thing concerning the fossils, does that help you understand how the flood occurred? No? That God brought the water down on the earth? With that great canopy gone, it explains a lot of things that happened after that. For instance, people lived for almost 1,000 years before that time. After the time of the flood, you see their lifespan becoming less and less and less. Now, why would that be? Because they were subject then to a number of influences they were not subject to before. Namely, all kinds of harmful rays coming from space and from the sun that would have not penetrated through the water layer before. Okay? So their bodies would have been affected in a radioactive fashion and by other kinds of harmful things from space. Their diet would have changed dramatically because the lush vegetation that was possible before the flood and was protected from harmful rays from space was now subject to the same kind of destruction they were subject to in their bodies, and so probably didn't produce the vitamins and proteins that were produced before the flood, which may explain why God said to Noah, now I give you the animals of the field to eat. To you they shall be for food. Why was that concession made? Probably, can't say for sure, but probably because the plants would no longer produce the kind of protein that was necessary and vitamins for man to be a strict vegetarian. And so God gave him permission to eat the animals. So you have the shortening of man's height, the shortening of man's lifespan, the change of diet, the change of climate would have eliminated the dinosaurs because their huge bodies could not have been kept warm in the He is like a good book. Keep coming back to you. You're also tired. You didn't even get it. Okay, and so the reptilian bodies would not have been supported by the atmosphere, and the circulatory system wasn't conducive to the lush vegetation. So a lot of their food was gone. The only thing that would have existed after that, in a dinosaur fashion, was probably for a while the ones that were in the water could have lived for a while, because everything that was on the earth, the Bible says, and had breath died. That was on the land. It doesn't say the things in the sea died. Okay? You see? And so the dinosaurs in the sea probably still existed for a short time afterwards. You know, who knows? Maybe a few decades, maybe a couple hundred years afterwards.
some of them in the ocean could have still existed, and in the great lakes that were formed. And so, you see then that the generations that were raised after the flood, which there had to be generations raised after the flood, right? The generations that were raised after the flood would have heard about the flood as an event, but wouldn't have known it as an actual thing. And then they would have questions about, well, what are these large things that live in the sea? Oh, well, those are some of the animals, that kind of animals that lived before the flood, but those were destroyed during the time of the flood. And the farther the story got from the actual event, the dimmer the story of the flood became in people's minds as they spread abroad over the earth. The dimmer that became, then the more likelihood there was that became what people understood as a myth. The myth of dragons and sea monsters. You see? Sea serpents and things like that. And so there's probably a very good basis for those kinds of myths in ancient literature. So how are fossils formed? Fossils are basically formed through some kind of energy, normally heat, and it can have pressure involved with it. It may not have pressure. It depends on the circumstances of the material. Fossilization of wood, which is commonly called petrification, is commonly thought to happen through water seepage. That water seeped, it was a thing within a position where water seeped into it for a long period of time, and over millions of years there was this mineral exchange that took place, right? Well, in Canada, there were some power lines that broke. And for a long time, the energy from the power lines, until they could get it stopped, was going into the ground, right? The bushes along the top of the ground where the electricity was released, the bushes were burnt, crisp, because they were, there was just carbon, because there was so much energy and they were in contact with oxygen. But the roots of those bushes, which were underground and not in contact with the abundance of oxygen, underwent a different effect. And you know what happened? Total mineral exchange. They were fossilized within a period of 2 hours. Total mineral exchange. And there's a guy who carries around a piece of this, a guy from Canada, and he gives it to the geologist and says, how long did that take to happen? The geologist says, well, it's petrified wood, it probably gets somewhere in the vicinity of 2 or 3 million years. Through what process? Through water seepage. He says, this happened in 2 hours through electricity. What are they going to do? The guy also has a piece of petrified wood that has an agate inside. And he goes to scientists and he says, he doesn't show them, you know, he says, how are agates formed? Heat and pressure. How is fossilized wood formed? Water seepage. Oh, how did that happen? He shows him a piece of agate inside this petrified wood. See? They have no explanation. He wanted to give it to a guy one time, an evolutionist that he showed it to. He wanted to give it to him, and the guy would not take it. He wouldn't take it. Yeah. Didn't want that contrary evidence lying around in his conscience. Okay, so pressure and heat, or some kind of energy is all that's necessary. And, I must go on, the principles of hydrodynamics can explain the general order of the strata. You know, you have the smaller, more spherical, and denser objects are at the bottom. The larger, less spherical, and less dense objects are at the top, such as mammals, right? There would be more drag on the body in a solution. The less the sphericity, is that the proper word? I think it's sphericity. Sounds right. Anyway, I'll make up a word if not. The less the sphericity of the object, the greater the drag is going to be in a solution. And then, of course, when we're talking about the flood, that's what we're talking about. Solution, right? Water, okay? So the greater the thing, the larger the thing, the lesser the density, and the greater the lesser the sphericity, the greater the complexity of the object, the more drag there will be on it, the longer it will stay in solution. You understand? And so the small things that are, especially the things from the sea, because they'll be closer to the bottom, the small things that are more like spherical objects, like trilobites and things like that, those are going to be closer to the bottom. They're going to settle out into solutions first. Okay? And the other things that are more complex and have a lesser density are going to be higher up. And so that explains the general order. The principles of hydrodynamics and fluidics explain the order, the general order in the strata. However, it also leaves room for mixture within one stratum. You have mixture of different constituents, because you could have that in a flood. And also, it leaves room for one layer being on top of another layer and being moved, or being laid down on top of another layer later. Okay? And how did the strata form? Well, the Bible says that the earth, when the water went off the earth, it says the water went off, coming and going. Okay? That's what the Hebrew word means. The water was abated from the earth, and when it went, the word that is used means coming and going, like a tide. And as it was coming and going, you see, the things that were more spherical, greater density, smaller objects, would be in the first layer. Things with a less density, and with more, less density, less sphericity, would be next layer, see, like that. And you get the layers laid down, and then the tremendous pressure of the water would also cause that to solidify. And so that would explain both the consistency in the strata, but also the inconsistency that you have, mixture and strata laid over each other. Now, what number were we on? Seven was fossils. How are fossils formed? Number eight was the flood and the strata, starting with the early earth. Number nine, I'm going to go on. What about if people create life in a test tube? What if they create life in a test tube? I'm going to do this very briefly. If somebody creates life in a test tube, all it proves is that it takes a mind to create life. Because you don't see it happening by chance in the laboratory. What you see is some very brilliant men, I'm sure they're more brilliant than I am, very brilliant men put certain chemicals together under certain conditions with a certain amount of energy for a particular period of time, and they produce an amino acid. Now, what does that mean? That means it takes a mind to create life. That's what that means. They did not go out and find some life happening by chance, and then go out and find life happening by chance 2,000 or 3,000 times more, and then say, according to our observations, life happens by chance. Okay? So, if someone were to actually make a living cell that could reproduce itself in a laboratory, I would clap and cheer and scream and holler. Why? Because they've shown that it takes a mind to make life. They cannot prove by the processes they're going through, they cannot prove that life happens by chance. They're not proving that. They're proving that life happens by design. Okay? So, it doesn't prove that God doesn't exist. It means that they found out a little bit about how God did it. Okay, number 10. I'm going to give you some, this is really interesting stuff. I'm going to give you some evidence of the superiority of ancient man. Evidence of the superiority of ancient man. Some archaeological evidence. I've already given you a little bit. For instance, the pyramids. The pyramids are still an enigma to modern man. How they built the pyramids, we really do not understand. We don't. We have ideas of what they may have done to be able to move the stones. We don't really completely understand that. But there's some things about the pyramids that are even more amazing than the size of the stones. The pyramids are laid down on a layer of what appears to be something like cement, and that layer is about as thick as a piece of paper. Now you try laying a 36-ton block on a piece of paper, or a piece of cement that's as thick as a piece of paper. We don't know if they managed to be able to put that under there after the blocks were there, or exactly how that worked. But it appears as if the pyramids are on the sand with
a layer of cement under them about as thick as a piece of paper. First of all, how did they figure out that that would support all that on the sand? They had to have quite the knowledge of physics to be able to do that. Another thing is, we don't know if they did it at the quarry or if they did it afterwards by drilling a hole down through the pyramid. But in one of the pyramids, the mummy, the pharaoh, that was buried there, the sun will shine down through that hole on one day out of the year, and it will shine on the face of the mummy. And that's on the king's birthday. Every other day, it misses his face. One day out of the year, the sun will shine down through that hole right on his face, the face of the mummy. How did they figure that out? They must have had some kind of knowledge of astronomy, right? And some really interesting knowledge of astronomy to know that on the king's birthday, every year it was going to do that. Now they also had to see, the thing is they also had to take in consideration leap years. And that was something that they knew about back then. You find lots of ancient cultures that included the idea of a part of a day. 365 days and a part of a day. You see? Because they knew that that changed. You find that in Africa, excuse me, you find it in South America, you'll find it in Mexico, you'll find it in North America. There are lots of cultures that had ideas of the rotation of planets. In South America, they knew that that Venus and the Earth went around the Sun. They knew that. And they knew down to within 1 second. One of them is one and one is, I have to think which one's the Earth and which one's Venus. They knew within 1 second how long it took for the Earth to go around the Sun. They knew within 7 seconds how long it took Venus to go around the Sun. About 4,000 years ago. How do they know that? Okay? Between 3,500 and 4,000 years ago. How did they figure that out? How about the stones of Baalbek? Can't even get a knife in between them. And they're just absolutely huge. I forget exactly what their dimensions are. They're something like, anybody seen them? Stones of Baalbek? They're something like, you've seen them? Oh, okay. You remember the dimensions of them? They're phenomenal. They're like 40 feet by 60 feet or some really, it's huge, huge thing. And they're all fit together so perfectly, you can't even get a knife in between them. Okay. No, this is actually, it's in Lebanon. It's in Lebanon at the moment. Is it, or is it lower Syria? I think it's in Lebanon, actually, at the moment. You know, people change their borders so frequently recently that you can't tell where they are. Okay. Anyway, it's on the Mediterranean, and they see there. Okay, how about Stonehenge? I'm sure you're familiar with Stonehenge. Still trying to figure out exactly what happened with Stonehenge. They found some grain that was kept in a particular part of Stonehenge that was perfectly preserved through, they don't know how many hundreds of years, and they think it may have to do with that Stonehenge may in some way be a very large machine with using stones that focuses energy on a certain aspect of the a certain point in the configuration, and it was there that they found that wheat, and it was perfectly preserved without any kind of covering or anything like that. And okay, we need to go on Stonehenge astronomy. Yes, a 1.5 volt battery that is in the Baghdad Museum that's dated at 1000 BC. Eyeglasses were found in China, dated 1000 BC, and they think that it may have been possible that they could have known enough technology about light and refraction to have made contact lenses, 1000 BC. How about there are some caves in France that have caveman paintings? You know how you see these pictures of caveman paintings and so forth? How many of you have heard about the cave paintings in France. Ever heard about those? How many of you have heard about the ones they don't show anybody because they can't figure them out? You don't hear too much about those, do you? You know why they can't figure them out?
because they are painted with exactly the same materials, painted in exactly the same style, and they show women in two-piece suits. They show the men with modern-type beret hats. They show the women carrying purses. They show the men in trousers. The cave paintings, which are supposedly as old as these other paintings, which are supposed to be, who knows, a million years old or whatever, and they show people dressed in basically modern French clothing. And so what do they do with those? They don't show them to anybody because they can't figure out what they're there for. They have concluded, they, the naturalists and evolutionists, have concluded that these must be a hoax, but they can't prove it. Same material, dated the same way. Okay. Why does it show people in that kind of situation? You know what I think happened? Mm-hmm. I think it was a very highly civilized civilization at that time, and it was judged. And what happens when somebody gets judged is that they have to flee with nothing. And where do you sleep the first night when you've had to flee for your life because God was pouring down fire on your entire country? You might find a cave to sleep in, right? Where will you live for the first while? In a cave. What kinds of, because all your delicate potteries and everything were destroyed, what kinds of pots are you going to make to hold your water and carry your water? Crude ones. How are you going to start your fire? You see? And the most delicate things, the most highly technological things, are the things that get destroyed first. You see? So cavemen don't show that things are old. They only show that people were living in extreme conditions. As far as I'm concerned, it could just as easily be that God judged civilization, and the result of that was they left behind, after they were judged, they left behind artifacts which appear to be very primitive simply because they had to work on developing the things again. Now, isn't that interesting? See where a lot of myths could come from? If we were judged, and we had to escape with our lives, and you knew that men had walked on the moon, and there was no evidence left of that, what would you tell your children? You know that people walked up there on the moon? Sure, Dad. Yeah. Well, I believe you, Dad. Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Goes off this penny. You know what my dad said? These people walked up there. And so myths and so forth would develop. There are pictures in Egypt of people in the sky in boats, also hanging upside down in reference to the earth, in ships in the sky. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean von Däniken is right? You see? Chariots of the gods? No, not necessarily. It's just simply that von Däniken, when he thinks backwards, he thinks down. You see? If he thought biblically, he would think up and go, well, maybe people back then did have some knowledge of space travel. Okay, how about some biblical evidence for the... We're getting there. We're almost finished with 10. Biblical evidence for the superiority of ancient man. Adam. Think about Adam. Made his own language up. You have quite a mind to make up your own language. Okay? So in tune with the creation, he could figure out a sound to represent everything that he experienced. He was told to take dominion over the whole earth. How would you like to have that job? Take dominion over the whole earth. Just the garden that he was placed in, if we can reconstruct it properly after the flood, it was quite rearranged by the flood, I'm sure, but it appears as if from the rivers that are named, the four rivers, if the garden was there in the midst of those rivers, which it says it was bounded by that, he had an area of about 200 square miles that he had to take care of as a garden. How would you like to take care of 200 square miles of garden? You'd need a helper, wouldn't you? Okay, so Adam and Eve were supposed to take care of this mammoth garden, and they were to take dominion over the whole world. Who knows what kinds of capacities they had as human beings? But, for instance, Cain. Cain knew about agriculture. Now, evolutionists say that's a very late development in the idea of man, with the human race, that man for a long time was a gatherer. All he did was gather things that grew naturally. And then later, he developed the idea. of agriculture. The Bible says men knew it right from the very beginning. They knew about agriculture. And Abel knew about animal husbandry right from the very beginning. He raised animals. How about musical instruments? It says there was a guy that made up all kinds of musical instruments. He created musical instruments. Actually, it says he is the creator of all musical instruments. You read these things very carefully. How about the other, another guy who says that it says he could make anything out of metal? Anything? Interesting idea. He could make anything from metal. And when people talked with each other, we find it very difficult to compose poetry, but they evidently talked with each other in poetry very often. Because when Lamech comes home and tells his wife that he's killed somebody, he did it in poetry. Isn't that interesting? Comes home, now, you wouldn't normally come home and tell your wife, I killed somebody. You know, you wouldn't do it in a poetic fashion, would you? Evidently, they spoke in poetry quite often. And then there are other places in the Bible that say things like this. There's one place that says that the sin of Israel, or is it Judah? I think it's Judah, has been written with an iron stylus with a diamond point. Now, what does that mean? They understood putting diamond on metal in order to engrave things in rock. Now, we thought that putting diamond-tipped tool, were the thought of man during the Industrial Revolution. But it says that the sin of Judah has been written with an iron stylus with a diamond point in the stone. Okay? Or the building of the temple. That was quite a feat. Right? It was all chipped out at the quarry, and then it was brought together so that not one hammer was heard at the building site. They put it all together there. Or the tabernacle. Some people are still trying to figure out exactly how Bezaleel pounded out of one piece of gold the things that he did, such as the lampstand. Still trying to figure out exactly how he would have done that. And what about cavemen? You know what I think about cavemen. They were people who were judged by God. Okay, and the conclusion is, number 11, hurrah. The conclusion is that evolution is contrary to physics, it is contrary to chemistry, it's contrary to scientific process, and it's contrary to good philosophy. Those are a few of the problems I have with evolution. Contrary to physics, the laws of physics, it's contrary to the laws of chemistry, it's contrary to scientific process, because it says that you're dealing with something that cannot be observed. Either it's too slow or it's too fast. And the fourth thing is it's contrary to philosophy in that you can never get absolute from the idea of evolution. There would be no absolute from the idea of evolution. Now, when you are talking about these things, last point here, when you are talking about these kinds of things, presuppositions, basically, dealing with a person's presuppositions. When you're talking with someone about that, you must remember that nobody is objective. Nobody. We are not objective. We are very prejudiced as Christians concerning our particular presupposition, aren't we? We believe very firmly that the universe is one way and that reality is a certain way. So we are very, very prejudiced. And when you're dealing with other people about their presuppositions, you must acknowledge that you are prejudiced too. And when you say, well, look, I'm very prejudiced, I know, in my particular view of the universe because I'm a Christian. And so I view the universe a certain way. But then nobody really is absolutely objective in their view of the universe. Everybody has a way of looking at it. So let's look at the different ways that we, you and I, look at the universe. Let's look at our presuppositions. That will help the person to be more objective and more open in talking with you than if you give the idea that you're objective and they're not. You see? We are not objective and we need to be honest with that, and it will help the person to be honest if we admit that, if we're honest with it. Okay? Now, right. Exactly how I feel.
Got to give you another point. I won't be able to tell you about Eastern religions later if I don't make this point. Okay, when the evolutionist or the naturalist or whatever works from his presupposition down to his conclusion, naturalist, right? Got that? Works down to his conclusion down here, which is evolution. Got that? Then within the system, he can do that logically. If you start with naturalism, you come to the conclusion of evolution logically. It fits within the system. Okay? When we say, as supernaturalists, that God made man, it fits within our system, right? That a supernatural being like God spoke a word and made man fits within the system, logically. That is what is called internal consistency. But there are two aspects to proving that something is true or giving evidence for it, and that is that things need to be not only internally consistent, philosophies also need to be externally consistent. Now what does that mean? That means that the philosophy that you propose also needs to be consistent with the world as it is. Now you see the problem here? Is that both evolution and creation are internally consistent with your presupposition, but not both of them are externally consistent with the world as it is. And that's what we've been doing for the last 2 hours, is showing you why it's inconsistent, okay? And so evolution does not fit the real world as it is or as we as human beings live. Do you feel like you're insignificant? Do you feel like you're an accident? Do you feel as if all you are is an animal? No. You see? Do you feel as if there are no absolute right and wrong? No. You don't feel like that, see? Whereas when we say that man was created, that does fit the real world as it is. See? I feel significant because I came from somewhere. I feel that there are real right and wrong because I came from a being that understands right and wrong. Right and wrong has always been. You see? I feel as if human life is worth something because I'm made in the image of another being who is valuable, and so I'm valuable. Okay? Whereas in evolution, okay, that doesn't work. So I told a guy one time, I said, if you see one, he asked me, he said, if you see one person kill another person, and you say that's wrong, and I see one person kill another person, and I say that's wrong, what's the difference? And I said, I'm honest and you're not. And he looked at me as if, you incredulous thing, you. How can you say that? And then I had to explain quickly what I meant. And I had to ask the Holy Spirit for help because I just blurted that out. I said, God help. And I said this. I said, if you start with the idea that man is only an accident through evolution, you cannot conclude that one accident eliminating another accident is a significant event. Okay? If I say that God made man in his image, and I say that one man made in the image of God by choice eliminated another man made in the image of God, that's a significant action. Okay? So I'm consistent with my presupposition over here, but you are not, because you are saying that an accident by accident eliminated an accident, and that is significant. So you're inconsistent. Okay? But then he had been involved in the Vietnam War, and I said, then you'd have to say that people dying in the Vietnam War wasn't a significant thing. Okay? He said, so then what do I do? And I said, well, you'll either have to change your conclusion and say that it isn't a significant action for one person to murder another person, or you'll have to change your presupposition. Change your presupposition. Ooh, became a Christian. Not while I was there. I got a letter from him later. But that is what we call internal and external consistency, and it is important for a philosophy, in order to be true, a philosophy must be both internally and externally consistent. Now, when you're talking with a naturalist, you need to be sensitive to the person as a person, and remember, even though he may have some very strange ideas that you think are funny or illogical, he is still a person, and you need to be open and sensitive to him as a human being. And
Truth is a very, very powerful thing, and we need to be very careful not to hurt other people who are made in the image of God with the truth that the Lord has shared with us.